So, welcome to Greg Haynes, author of Tree of Life, the Mythical Archetype, Revelations from the Symbols of Ancient Troy. It's our pleasure to welcome him to this first talk here at Many Rivers.
Thank you all for coming. It's wonderful to see some familiar faces and some new faces also. The subject of our talk tonight is mythology. But before we launch into it, maybe we should define our terms a little bit. Myth is a word that has different meanings for different people. For some, oh, that's just a myth, meaning, oh, it's a story that purports to be true but isn't really. That's not how we're going to be using it tonight here. One of the definitions I like most was used by Wendy Doniger O'Flaherty from the University of Chicago. She says, myth is the other guy's religion. So the birth of Buddha from the side of his mother as she holds on to the tree of life is a myth. The birth of Set from the Egyptian goddess Nut from her side, he forces his way out through her side, is a myth. The birth of Dionysus from the thigh of Zeus is a myth. But oh no, the birth of Eve from the side of Adam, oh no, that's not a myth. The way I'm going to use the word is really has no judgment in terms of its truth value. I use the word to describe any miraculous story that is held to be sacred in some tradition or culture. True, false, we don't know, but any kind of a miraculous story that's held to be sacred. So if I use the word myth to describe a story that you hold sacred in your tradition or whatever it is, don't take it amiss, don't take it personally as an attack on that or challenging the veracity of it. No. I look at them all neutrally. So the focus of our talk tonight is going to be on the mythology of the great goddess. But I thought I would just take a moment to talk a little bit about how the clarity of the presentation of the interpretation of the great goddess myth came to be. And it really came about through a process of trying to interpret the symbols on the symbols found at ancient Troy. In the 1870s, Heinrich Schliemann, archaeologist, unearthed the city of ancient Troy. He found thousands of round ceramic objects with a hole in the center and mysterious signs and symbols around them. And no one has ever been able to figure out what these symbols mean. There have been many interpretations, but none of them were quite convincing. Schliemann himself had a few ideas, other people have had some ideas. But it's work that remains to be solved, and so I've been working on it. Some examples. So these are spindle whirls. And you can see crosses, swastikas. This is a curved type of swastika. Strange curved line segments around the periphery. Trees. More swastikas. This is a comb-like figure. We need to also differentiate the goddess that we're going to be talking about tonight, the so-called great goddess, from the goddess that was identified by Maria Gimbutas in what she called Old Europe, in Southeast Europe, the Balkans and Romania. She found, maybe some of you are familiar with this, Madonna of Willendorf. It's very much of a fertility goddess, all breasts and belly and buttocks and so on. That's not the kind of forms that we're going to be seeing so typical of the great goddess. But some of these symbols are found on both sets of artifacts, and so it's hard to understand exactly what the history was in relationship between those. But Maria Gimbutas said, well, you know, this matriarchal culture that she unearthed with this goddess central figure and so on, this, she believed, was the comb or the hairbrush of the goddess. Heinrich Schliemann said, no, this is a flaming altar. Here, this is the two legs of the altar, and these are the flames rising from the altar. So it's all over the map in terms of what these symbols mean. Okay. We also find... I'm going to put this down just a little bit because it's cut off at the top. We also find numerous animal figures. I call them stags. Schliemann called them antelopes. A lot of different figurines. Swastika appears many, many times on these artifacts. This is a symbol that goes back 7,000-8,000 years in the archaeological record. There have been innumerable studies and suggestions as to what this symbol means, but there again, it's something that no one knows. It's been called the symbol of the earth, a symbol of the sun, a symbol of the rotation of the cosmos, of the stars, many different ideas. I'm going through these quickly, but we'll be coming back to them. Now, the spindle whorls, this illustrates exactly how they were used. You see, this is an archaic Greek figurine. Women of all social levels spun in the ancient world, from the lowliest slave to the queen. They all spun. And it was something of a sacred activity in antiquity. So there's a wooden distaff here that's spun. And without the spindle whorl, it just wouldn't go very far. It wouldn't have much spin to it. And so they put this, it's like a counterweight, and it gives some angular momentum to the twist that the spinner puts on it, and then she pulls out bits of wool and feeds it into the twist of the from the spindle whorl and makes yarn out of it. So this technology of the distaff and the spindle whorl has been found all over the world. Same way, here's a Navajo woman using the same kind of method. She then after the yarn is spun, then she winds it around the distaff. Now, the intuition about the meaning of the symbols on the Trojan spindle whorls that I suggest is that these whorls and these symbols represent elements of the ancient Axis Mundi mythology. Now, Axis Mundi means, Mundi is the world, and Axis Mundi means the axis of the world. And ancient people looked up into the sky and they saw the North Celestial Pole, North Star, and they saw all the stars revolving around the Celestial Pole. And they were at a loss of how to explain this. This is an incredible mystery. Why are the stars moving in this way? And they imagined that the Earth was a disk, and it must have been spinning, which gave the appearance of the movement of the stars. But there must have been something at the center of this spinning Earth, just like the spindle whorls had the distaff. Well, there must be something like that on Earth in order to fill out the pictures, because it was inconceivable that something would just spin on its own. Whenever you had a wheel, it had an axle. When you had a spindle whorl, it had a distaff. And so there was this attempt to explain that. And so many different variations on this myth were developed all over the world. Oftentimes, they imagined that there was a great tree at the center of the world, parallel, like the wooden pole of the distaff of the spindle whorl, great tree, and it was right there at the center of the world. Sometimes instead of a tree, there would be a great mountain at the center of the world, a mountain 30 miles high, they said. Sometimes a great mountain with a tree at the top. Sometimes there was a pillar at the center of the world. The mythology sometimes also describes a god or a goddess standing there at the center point of the twirling earth disk, standing and holding up the heavens, separating the heavens from the earth below. So you find this myth occurring over and over again in many, many parts of the world. Interestingly enough, there are a few parts of the world where it does not occur. Sub-Saharan Africa, Australia, Oceania. No. These very remote areas, the mythology does not exist in the same way. But all throughout Eurasia, North Africa, and even in Mesoamerica, pre-Columbian Mexico and Central America. So I'm going to just go through and describe a few examples of this mythology of the Axis Mundi, so that people have an idea of what this represents, and then we'll get into the goddess question. So, this is a depiction by William Blake, Adam and Eve, the Archangel Gabriel, the Tree of Life in the distance, the serpent coiling up the tree. Perhaps you might make out some fruits of immortality, animals nearby, Archangel Gabriel, arms uplifted, Adam even almost. And when you see Eve in axial position with the Tree of Life, this is not by accident. This is either conscious or subconscious identification of the goddess with the Tree of Life. And we'll see this over and over again. So, for those of you who don't quite remember your biblical stories, God created a garden, Eden, in the very center of which he placed this Tree of Life. It had fruits of immortality. There was a serpent that lived in the vicinity. He made the first man and then opened up the side of the first man and took out a rib and made the first woman. There were four rivers that diverged from this Tree of Life in Eden, and they flowed outward in different directions. The Bible even tells us the names of these rivers, and I'll belabor this a little bit because it's important. There's one more chair right here. So the Bible says, one of the rivers is the Gihon, which encompasseth the land of Cush, which we know as Ethiopia. So most speculation is the river Gihon was the Nile. There was the Tigris and the Euphrates and the Pison. Now, the Pison River, nobody knows where that is. It was said to encompass the land of Havilah, where there's gold, and the gold of the land is good, and there's bdellium and the onyx stone. Okay, well, Havilah, no one knows where Havilah is. There were some gentlemen by the name Havilah, and they lived in Arabia, but there's no indication that was where the land of Havilah was. The only place on earth where those three items occur together, gold, bdellium, which is a type of myrrh, and the onyx stone, which is a semi-precious stone in alternating layers of white and black, the cameos were carved into it. Those three items exist only in one place together, in one place on earth, and that's Brazil. And this makes no sense at all. The Nile has its source in Central Africa. The Tigris and Euphrates don't share a source. They both come from an area in the eastern part of Turkey. Havilah, no one knows where it is. And so the location of these mysterious rivers of creation remain a mystery. So, we also find the story of this Tree of Life or Axis Mundi mythology in Greece. This is the goddess Leucothea, whose name means white goddess. She has a cornucopia, and she is feeding the god Dionysus with ambrosia from her cornucopia. Here is a tree. We know it's the Tree of Life because there's a serpent coiling up the tree. Here's his head. And one feature of the story, which does not occur in Genesis, but occurs in many, many occurrences of this myth, is the location of birds at the place where the tree branches off. A lot of times, the myth describes the tree branching in two directions, and right at the place where it branches is a bird or two birds. Sometimes the bird is a swan, other times it's an eagle, sometimes it's both. There are other examples within Greek mythology of this theme. Jason and his Argonauts travel to capture the Golden Fleece. They ask the king to give it to them, and the king says no. Well, what happens is the king's daughter falls in love with Jason, and against her father is half divine. His father is the sun god. And so he prohibits her from having anything to do with Jason. So going against this divine prohibition, she and Jason go. She knows she's an enchantress, so she has magic spells, and she puts the serpent to sleep who's guarding this tree, and she tells Jason, "Grab it," and then off they go. On their way there, they pass four rivers, each flowing into one of the four cardinal directions. One flows with water, one with milk, one with wine, and one with honey. So the similar elements are found in this story. You can say, okay, yes, each individual occurrence of the myth has its own local accretions, but the basic original elements of the story you can identify and see them again and again. Another Greek story is the story of the daughters of Atlas, the Hesperides, which means those from the west. They guard a tree that bears fruits of immortality, guarded by a serpent, Ladon. And the place where the Hesperides are said to live is an island out in the Atlantic Ocean, west of Gibraltar, west of the Pillars of Hercules. Time and time again, you have references to this island, the Celtic mythology, always talking about an island in the west, a misty island of Avalon, or wherever, where the apples of immortality can be found, and so on. It's also significant that these Hesperides were the daughters of Atlas, because Atlas is one of these Axis Mundi gods who holds up the sky, separating it from the earth below. So, this is a drawing of an ancient Chaldean seal. And this is probably the oldest illustration we have of the Tree of Life in all of archaeology. Chaldea was located in Mesopotamia, 3,000-4,000 years BC, if I'm not mistaken. Here again we see perhaps male and female god and goddess, hard to say. Tree of Life, serpent. If we had more time, I could show many, many examples of depictions of the Tree of Life in ancient Mesopotamia. It was a very important part of their religion. In Tibet, this is a Tibetan mandala. In Tibet, at the center of the world, is the nine-story swastika mountain. It occurs right next to the sacred Jambu tree, the Tree of Life. In each of the four cardinal directions, there are gates. These are double swastika gates, they're called in amongst anthropologists, because you see the swastika turns to the right and it also turns to the left. You see that in many times in various depictions of the swastika. Sometimes it turns to the right, sometimes to the left. The idea that one of them means positive, the other means negative, or the kind of urban legend that says that, well, Hitler took the image of the swastika that was positive and a benediction, and he turned it reversed, and that meant evil, and so on. None of that has any basis in fact. No, you find it amongst the American Indians all over the world, turning in both directions in similar environments. So here, the Tibetans had a structure where the swastika turned left and right. And you can see in each of the four cardinal directions, there's a river symbol. So we're seeing the same elements over and over again. Sir William Jones was an early anthropologist, and he talked about this Tree of Life in Tibet. He says, I'm going to read this quote. "The largest and richest sort of fruit is named Amrita." That means immortality, immortal. "Amrita," or immortal. "And the mythologists of Tibet, applying the same word to a celestial tree bearing ambrosial fruit and adjoining to four vast rocks from which as many sacred rivers derive their several streams." So we'll come back to this, but this is important. Four vast rocks. Four rivers flowing from each of these vast rocks, all meeting at one point in the center. It's a celestial tree, so this is taking us away from the earth and into the realm of the stars. And here again, the fruits of immortality. In ancient India, Mount Meru, Mount Sumeru, as it's sometimes called, and even sometimes Mount Mandara, stood at the center of the world. Four rivers, there was a great river from heaven, flowed down from the celestial spheres, and when it reached Mount Mandara, it divided into four streams flowing into the four cardinal directions. Now, the names of the rivers in ancient India have Indian names, and they correspond to rivers well known in India. This is a depiction of when the gods decided to spin Mount Mandara. This is the god Vishnu sitting in the axial position on top of a pillar that rests on the back of a tortoise. And they took this serpent, and they looped it once around, and they whipped it, kind of like a fire drill. And they spun it so hard that it began, the mountain, the vegetation on Mount Meru began to glow like a fire that never is consumed. And as this gathered speed and whirling, a drink of immortality, the Amrita, was formed. And at the same time, the goddess Shri or Lakshmi was formed through this process. At the same time, the sacred tree of life was formed through this spinning. So here you see this whirling axial motion again. This is why we can identify this with the Axis Mundi motif, because we're relating it to this whirling of the heavens. Now, even as far east as China, there is a story of a sacred peach tree that stood at the center of the world, and four rivers flow out from this peach tree. And those four rivers are named in the legends, and they all have Chinese names, and they are all well-known, identifiable rivers that now exist in China. So, using a comparative approach, we can say, okay, certain elements of the stories were original, and others were local accretions. So, for example, the idea of a mountain at the center of the world, four rivers that flowed in four cardinal directions, those seem to be original to the story. They appear everywhere. But the names of the rivers, Chinese, Hindu, Hebrew, and so on, those obviously are local names that have been given to the story. So using this kind of comparative approach, then we're going to try to sift between to determine what the original myth really looked like, and then, based upon that information, make an attempt to describe the origin of that story. Now, we'll just briefly look at some of these spindle whirls in a little bit more detail. The conclusion that we came to was that the symbols represent elements of this archaic Axis Mundi mythology. So this cross-like feature perhaps represents these four rivers that diverge from a central point. And these meandering lines do kind of suggest a river symbology. So that's what we're looking toward. Here we see trees, could be tree of life. Now, the latter motif is interesting because in many, many stories, the tree of life acts as a ladder that links the underworld, the earth, and the heavens. And the souls of the dead, the departed souls, climb this ladder in order to reach their abode in the sky. Osiris and various Egyptian gods help the souls on their way up the ladder. You see this is all over. This motif recurs again and again. So here again, this could be consistent with the Axis Mundi mythology. The Scandinavian legends are some of the most revealing. They're the most well preserved. And according to that legend, there is a tree that has its roots in the underworld. Its trunk passes through the earth, and its branches reach heaven. At the highest branch, there is a goat, and he nibbles leaves from the tree, and from the udder of this goat, ambrosia flows down, fills a cauldron that's an inexhaustible cauldron. Also, in the top of this this tree, Yggdrasil by name in the Scandinavian mythology, there are four stags, and those stags From their antlers, dewdrops fall down in such profusion that they fill all the rivers of the world. Schliemann himself, the archaeologist that excavated Troy, suggests that perhaps these animals could relate to the Gandharva legend in ancient Sanskrit mythology. The Gandharvas were half-animal mythological figures that lived near the Tree of Life. And interestingly, etymologically, the word Gandharva is related to the Greek word kentaur, which the Romans spelled it with a C. They didn't have a K, and so it came into our language as centaur. So the centaurs are these mythological creatures. So there could be this relationship between these mythical animals and the Tree of Life, Axis Mundi mythology. The swastika, again, we talked about that, appears frequently many times. Perhaps this represents these four rivers, again, that cross, that meet at a common point. Now, these curved line segments around the periphery of the spindle whorls that occur so often have been a subject of lack of agreement. Schliemann thought that these are rising suns, rising from the different directions, and therefore the Trojans must have been a country of sun worshippers. Good guess. Why not? Good guess, but no necessarily in any internal consistency to it, nothing that would make you say, oh yeah, obviously. No, it's like, well, okay, perhaps. Here again, Tree of Life, the same curved line segments. Often there are four, like on these. Sometimes it's used three, sometimes seven or eight, but mostly four. So here again, the comb of the goddess, perhaps, or the flaming altar, and the curved, the rising suns, according to Schliemann. And remember, this hole in the center was where the wooden distaff was originally put, and then the whole thing was used as a spinning. Now we're getting closer to our subject of tonight's talk, the goddess. Here, often, sometimes, occasionally, you find in these Trojan spindle whorls, could be a god, but I prefer to call her a goddess, because we see in many other cases, this probably in more cases than not, it is a goddess in this situation. And look, she has her hands in this upraised position. We'll see this again and again, this mysterious position of the goddess. Here she is, surrounded by these four circular objects, whatever they are. So, perhaps a plausible explanation for the meaning of these symbols on the Trojan spindle whorls, but not conclusive. We're going to have to look for some more evidence to prove that. But anyway, this is what got us started on this. Here's another depiction of this goddess. And here again, the upraised arms. Again, the stags. Now we're really getting into our subject here, the goddess. Interestingly enough, the great goddess often appears as a trio of goddesses. In the ancient Germanic Scandinavian mythology, these are the three Norns. Perhaps a modern interpretation is that one, their names that they're given is one is the past, the other present, the other the future. But this same motif of three goddesses, they're always goddesses of fortune, goddesses of destiny. And in Greek mythology, we have the three Moirai. In the Roman mythology, the three Parcae. But they're always three goddesses. And they're always spinners. And so this is relating this concept of spinning with this twirling, spinning of the stars. One goddess spins the thread of a human being's life. Another goddess measures the length of it to see how long he or she will live. And a third goddess snips the thread at the moment of his death. So, although, you know, Zeus and so on was considered the king of the gods and so on, in later times, the goddesses of fate were considered much more powerful and more important than all of the other gods. Here we see an ancient Egyptian artifact, a vase or an urn, from the earliest period of Egyptian archaeology, way before the dynastic period. And here, the same kind of posture of a goddess with upraised arms. Crude, not particularly well formed, but unmistakable. This is another figure made of baked Nile mud. Same goddess. Notice some particular features which we'll see again and again. Fused legs. Upraised arms. And this goddess often has issues with her head. In this case, she's given the head of a bird. A lot of times you'll see, like, Isis was beheaded by her son Horus because she went against his wishes. Oftentimes the head of the goddess is taken away and she's given a cow's head or a bird's head, or there's some funny business going on with her head. Time and time again you see this. And this is a side view of the same artifact, and you can see more clearly the bird's head that she has. Art historians have puzzled over this figure, which recurs so frequently, with the goddess with upraised arms. Now, I even have a quote here that I thought you might be interested in. This is a well-known art critic. He says, "The wide diffusion of this motif, that of the goddess with the upraised arms, is evidence of the symbolic nature of this unusual posture. Its interpretation as a dance is not wholly satisfactory, but rather raises the question of what this dance attitude is supposed to express. Is it an act of homage to a divinity? Or is it the goddess herself, a great mother, lifting her arms up to heaven? Or are the arms supposed to imitate the cow's horns of the sky goddess?" So, again, the significance of this form is not understood. Another Egyptian artifact. Here you see the goddess with the upraised arms. You see the ladder motif. Appears to be part of the similar motif. Here again, you see the ladders. You see the goddess with upraised arms. You see the antelopes or stags. Oops. This is the great mother goddess of Egypt. Nut is her name. You can see her again in this, I call it the Axis Mundi gesture. Nut is the mother of the main gods of Egypt, Osiris, Nephthys, Isis, and Set. And as I mentioned earlier, Set was forced his way out instead of being born through the usual birth canal. He forced his way out through her side. She's often identified with the sky, the night sky, typically. We'll see more of Nut later on. This is Hathor, another Egyptian goddess. Same gesture. Legs either fused or close together. Arms upraised. She occurs next to this figure. This is the Egyptian zodiac, the astrological signs through which the sun and the planets and the moon pass. These figures holding up the sky. This is Shu, who we'll see again later. This is Hera, the great mother goddess, queen goddess of Greece, wife of Zeus. Like Isis, like many other goddesses, she's always described as wearing a veil. The goddess is often veiled. Once a year, she takes a bath in a pool, which restores her virginity. There are some stories told about Hera which have been described by scholars of mythology as being so obscure as to be impossible to interpret. One such story that I recall is that Zeus, one time Hera misbehaved, and so to punish her, Zeus forged golden bracelets and hung her from Mount Olympus and tied golden anvils to her legs to pull her down, and she had to remain there in this position. No one was allowed to help her or free her, none of her children, no one. And so, scholars have said, there's no way we'll ever be able to understand what this story represents. Hera has a relation to the celestial spheres, because one important feature of the universe was created from the milk that spilled from her breast. Hera was always causing problems for Hercules, and at one point at the end of his life, they were reconciled, and she adopted him as an adopted son, and part of the ceremony to represent that, yes, they were now reconciled and he would be her adopted son, is he had to crawl out from between her legs as if a symbolic birth, and he had to suck on her breast. But poor Hercules, he never knew his own strength, and he sucked too hard, and so milk spilled out from her breast and created the Milky Way. Hera is not very well known or appreciated, but I love the figure of Hera. She's an incredibly complex and interesting mythological character. This, perhaps the great goddess par excellence, Isis, Egyptian goddess, originally Egyptian goddess, but her cult spread in the Alexandrian period all over the ancient Mediterranean world. She had cults in Greece and in Rome. She became one of the major religious cults that was worshipped. She's always wearing her veil. Here you see she's standing in axial alignment with the Djed pillar. The Djed pillar is identified very strongly with Osiris. But here again, we're remembering this Axis Mundi imagery of a tree, a pillar, a mountain, or a god or a goddess. Isis, true to form, legs close, tight together, and arms upraised. We could spend a whole evening on Isis and not waste our time.
Yeah, how many years BC are we talking about with this?
In Egypt, the gods underwent various manifestations and transformations, and so what might be called Nut in one city-state could be called Hathor or Isis in another. So these goddesses were often interchangeable. And so they go back to the earliest period of the dynastic period. But if what we're presenting here is correct, that is that there's a continuity between Isis with her arms upraised and her legs together with that figurine of Nile mud that goes back to the earliest pre-dynastic period, 3000 BC, at least.
I think, wasn't there a Roman temple to Isis built in London? And when they were excavating or grading for something out of Heathrow, they stumbled onto it, and it has now been archaeologically.
Mm-hmm. Many of the Roman soldiers were devotees.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Who's this? Anybody recognize her? This is Lilith. Lilith is a mysterious goddess. She was the first wife of Adam. She ran away from him in a quarrel. They had a quarrel, and she ran off, flew off. And she later times was given connotations of being an evil temptress, sorceress, and so on. But Lilith, there's another story that the tree of life was called the Halupu tree. And Inanna, the great goddess of Mesopotamia, saw the tree, and when it was small, and the river had washed away its roots, so she carried it to her garden and planted it in her garden. Because later she wanted to, when it was large, she wanted to cut it down and make a couch for herself. But meanwhile, Lilith had climbed up into the tree and carved out a cave or a house and was living in the side of the tree, and a bird was living in the branches, and a serpent living in the base, and so she couldn't approach it, and so she had to get Gilgamesh to help her. So anyway, this is a further development of Lilith. Quite a fascinating story. This is from ancient Greece, from the oldest periods, archaic period. Again, fused legs, arms upraised, head of a bird, but with, you know, human goddess features of her breasts. So, you know, we started looking at this motif of this goddess, the upraised arms, from the Trojan spindle world, but here it appears all over. This is Aphrodite. Some people will say, oh, Aphrodite, goddess of love. Well, I'm sorry. She was much more complex than that. Certainly she was a goddess that embodied eroticism and fickleness and so on, but she had many different sides to her. She was at one time described as a spinner. She and Hera and Athena were vying for the golden apple, which Paris had to give to the one who he thought was the most beautiful. Aphrodite had rigged the game so that she got it. Anyway, but here again, you see her with the... a lot of times you see this goddess figure, but it's all variations of this. Rarely do you see the arms down. No, they're in an uplifted position like this. Why? So, for all of you observers of the stars and the night sky, this won't come as a surprise, but this is a time-lapse photograph of the motion of the stars around the North Celestial Pole. Polaris, the North Star, you see here, and all the stars, they appear to move in this direction around the North Star. So you can imagine that ancient people would, what is this? Where is the god that's spinning this spindle whirl that is our Earth? Oh, what's this?
Odin.
This is my depiction of the Tree of Life. Now I remember what I was going to say. So, all right, here is the greatest spinning spindle whirl that we can imagine. It's our whole Earth. And here is the center of rotation. But where's the distaff? Where's the distaff of the spindle whirl? Do you see it? It's there. Can you see it? Well, I think the photograph was exposed for such a long period of time that all the lights obscured the feature that I'm talking about. But somewhere right near this North Star is an astronomical feature that looks a lot like a tree in the night sky. This is the Milky Way galaxy. Now, this is the North Star, position of the North Star. Now, the Milky Way galaxy... This is a picture of the Andromeda galaxy. It's the closest one to us. And it's very similar in structure to our galaxy. And our sun is like somewhere in the outer one-fourth of the galaxy. So when you're looking in the plane of this galaxy, the Milky Way appears to circle all around the Earth. When you're looking at this, it's toward the center of the galaxy, you see it quite brightly, but everywhere you look within that plane is a very bright cluster of stars. It's unmistakable, and you have to see it on a really dark, clear night. But it has this form. Part of the galaxy is obscured by clouds of interstellar gas. And this creates this dark band through the center of part of it. So it has the appearance of a tree with two branches rising out of it. And And there are other features of the galaxy too, like what's this? This wound or womb in the side of the trunk of the tree. This is likewise another cloud of dark matter that obscures part of it. So it appears to be a wound or womb, and this is, you see this again and again. I mentioned oftentimes the god is born from the side, but in many cases the god or the hero has a wound in the side, the thigh, the genitals, or the leg. And this appears over and over again. Hercules has a wound, an old wound in his thigh. Odysseus has a wound in his thigh. I mentioned Zeus gives birth to the god Dionysus from his thigh. So many, many, many times you see the same kind of motif. So the other interesting aspects of this Milky Way is that there are constellations in proximity to it. And in the crotch of the tree here are two bird constellations, Cygnus the swan and Aquila the eagle. And so down at the base, I neglected to mention an important feature of these Axis Mundi myths. Oftentimes there's a dog or two dogs that guard the entrance to the underworld. Cerberus in Greek mythology guards the entrance to the underworld. You even see this in Hindu mythology, the two sons of Sarama, these two dogs that guard the entrance to the underworld. So so the galaxy, this is the northern hemisphere portion of the galaxy, but it actually goes all the way around the Earth, comes back in a great circle. And the celestial equator runs about like this. And so all those portions beyond here are in the underworld. And so these two dogs, there's a constellation of Canis Major and Canis Minor on both sides of the galaxy right here in this position. And then there's a constellation, Hydra the serpent, right in this position. He's coming up from the underworld and just sticking his head above the horizon. So I'm suggesting that the Milky Way galaxy informed many of these myths, that there was a mythological substratum based upon ancient knowledge of the sky, and that this was taken in various civilizations and through variations and changes and so on, gave rise to much of the mythology that we see and know from these various cultures. Now, going back to the goddess, Zeus had many escapades. He impregnated a girl, and she became pregnant. And when her father, this was the goddess, this was the Mira, when her father saw that she was pregnant, he was going to kill her for fornication. And she explained, no, this was a god did this, and I had nothing to do with it. And the father refused to believe her, and so he chased her. He was going to kill her. And in order to save her from death, she was changed into a tree, the myrrh tree. And just as she, and so her arms became branches, you can see her arms became branches. And just as her body crystallized into wood, the god Adonis was born from the side of the tree. I love this story. Here's another example of it. Mira with her arms upraised, her legs fused into the trunk of a tree, and the miraculous birth of the god from the side of the tree. Now, we have been seeing depictions of this Axis Mundi goddess, but in often cases it's also depicted as a god with all the same or similar elements. Here you have the Egyptian god Shu. He's standing in the same kind of position. And arching over him is our old friend, the goddess Nut, the mother goddess of Egypt. And here she is. She has her arms outstretched like this. But instead of just standing straight like this, she's arching over the world. And And this is actually a more accurate depiction of the goddess, the galaxy goddess, because the Milky Way does actually arch over the sky. And just about overhead is where the arms of the Great Rift split apart. And those arms reach down and they almost touch the horizon. And so I suggest that Newt symbolically represents that formation. Now this is down on the Earth. This is Geb. And he is the husband of Newt. And he was so heartbroken when Shu separated him from his wife, Newt, that he shed tears in such profusion that they filled all the rivers of the world. So again, you see the same element of the rivers playing into this. Again, a male manifestation of this Axis Mundi god. Now, you notice a peculiarity about Atlas carrying the spheres on his shoulders is that his head bows down beneath the level of his shoulders, and so he's fulfilling this archetype of the Milky Way. Here's again another depiction of Atlas. I love this. This was actually part of an illustration to a book published in 1559 in London. And you see Atlas with his arms raised in Axis Mundi posture. These are the spheres of the heavens. He's wearing a crown because he's, according to Plato, he's king of the land of Atlantis. Atlantis means the island of Atlas. Atlantis means of Atlas. And you can see this is the ocean here, so he's on his island. And you can see here the spheres of the heavens. This is the Axis Mundi. And you can always tell the Axis Mundi because it has a fleur-de-lis at the top. And you can see this is the Arctic Circle, this is the Tropic of Cancer, the equator, the Tropic of Capricorn. So ancients, this is actually based upon an armillary sphere, an ancient medieval pointing device that they used to track the motions of the stars and planets. I have another more clear example of that. But you notice the Axis Mundi imagery in this illustration. So here's the Axis Mundi. And look, it lines up with a tree, and the tree has a wound in its side. Think of the Scandinavian tree of life, Yggdrasil, where the stories tell about how Yggdrasil has a rotting place in its side. Now, there's one other very unusual peculiarity about this drawing. Something is really wrong. Can anybody see what that is? Something's wrong. If you don't see it right now, we'll come back to this, because it's very important.
Well, I'm wondering what the other two most major bands are.
This is the ecliptic. This is the motion of the sun and the planets. This is, you can see these star. These are, Gemini, Aries, and the Pisces, the two fish, and so on. So these are the astrological course of the sun and the planets through the sky. This is the horizon. So this is another example of a armillary sphere, as I mentioned, a medieval pointing device to measure the inclinations, declination of the stars and so on. Notice again, the parts are labeled. This is, Tropic of Capricorn, Tropic of Cancer, Equator, and so on. And this central pillar, the central shaft of the whole thing, is labeled Axis Mundi. And you can see the fleur-de-lis at the northern end of the Axis Mundi. This is typically the way it was portrayed. I draw attention to this fleur-de-lis marking the Axis Mundi because of something we're going to see here. Again, an example from ancient Persia of the god, in this case a male god, in the same kind of Axis Mundi position. He's holding the winged disc. This could be Ahura Mazda. No one's sure exactly which god it is. This is a river symbolism here and here. Even in Mesoamerica, this is from the Aztec culture of Mexico, archaeologists, anthropologists call these figures. See, this represents the sky. And these figures that are holding up the sky in this way, they're called Atlanteans, meaning like Atlas, the way he holds up the sky in the Greek mythology. So you find these you know, even strangely enough, even in the Americas, pre-Columbian America, this is an interesting story. Ixion, he made bold to try to seduce Hera, Zeus's wife. Zeus got wind of it, was angry, and punished him by tying him to a whirling flaming wheel, and he put it in the sky, and so Ixion remains in the sky, and he whirls on this flaming wheel, and these are snakes. He's bound to the wheel by snakes. So this whirling vortex axial motion of a wheel, the snakes, the fire representing the glowing nature of the Milky Way. But interestingly enough, you find this over and over again in ancient mythology. The hero or god is hung from the Axis Mundi. I already described how Hera was hung by the golden bracelets from Mount Olympus. Ixion, strapped to the Axis Mundi. And we'll see this theme over and over again. Odysseus, his raft is sucked into a whirlpool and is pulled down into the sea, and he grabs hold of a tree and he holds onto it, and so he's hanging from this ancient old fig tree over this whirling vortex motion. You can see remnants of this Axis Mundi mythology even in some of those stories from the Iliad and the Odyssey. Here is another god strapped or hung, bound to the Axis Mundi. This is Prometheus. Prometheus fell afoul. He tricked Zeus, and Zeus punished him by binding him to a pillar. And every day, an eagle comes and pecks a hole in his side and feeds on his liver. And so, here again, the same kind of motif. A pillar. Notice how they're resting on this pillar here also. And here's the serpent motif. Notice that this pillar retains certain arboreal characteristics, these kind of Art Nouveau kind of leaves down below. You see that even in the Hindu mythology, the great pillar at the center of the world is called the Skamba, but it also has features of a tree. So the tree, the pillar, are interchangeable. So, and where was Prometheus bound to this pillar? Well, we don't know. There are some conflicting accounts, but we do know that when Hercules had to perform his labors, he visited numerous rivers. He visited the Nile. He visited the Eridanus, which we'll come to. He also had to cross the ocean. One time from Spain, he got the golden goblet of the sun, and he crossed the ocean from Spain to the opposite mainland in order to capture some of the cattle of the sun god. And on his way there, and then he also had to cross again from North Africa, and he crossed the ocean again to the opposite mainland, and on his way he found Prometheus on an island bound to the pillar, and he released him. So here again, this Axis and Prometheus bound somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean somewhere. Don't believe it when people say, oh, ancient people didn't know about the American continents. You just read Plato. He talks in the Timaeus and the Critias, he talks about how outside the Pillars of Hercules there was an island called Atlantis, and it was the gateway to the other side of the ocean, where there was a true continent over there on the other side. They knew all about this. So here you see, again, much of Axis Mundi mythology incorporated into the Christian symbolism. Here, Christ is crucified on the Tree of Life. We know it's the Tree of Life because the serpent is coiling up. We also see Adam and Eve here. Adam's taking another bite out of the apple. These are the saints looking on and so on. So, and here, Christ, you see his feet have been nailed together, and so his legs are fused, and he's also in the same position with upraised arms. The story goes, according to the Gospel, that when he hung on the cross, a Roman soldier pierced his side with a sword, and so Christ is suffering the same cosmic wound that we've encountered so frequently in other contexts. Here you can see him with his arms in Axis Mundi position and his wound in his side. here. He's taken up to heaven after his crucifixion, and so he's actually flying through the sky in this position with the upraised arms and the fused legs. Here you can see that Christ is crucified on the Axis Mundi, because you see the fleur-de-lis. And so this was, in ancient times, a clear marker for the Axis Mundi. So you can see the wound in his side, his upraised arms, his legs fused, and so on. So pretty unmistakable vestiges of this ancient Axis Mundi symbolism. As we've already talked about, Eve, born from the side of Adam, and Adam is laying here, he's near the tree of life. This represents God. Same image, this time from the painter William Blake. I love this picture, so I just threw it in. This is Maya. She's the mother of Buddha. She holds onto a branch of the tree of life, and Buddha is born from her side. This is from ancient India. Here again, Maya holding the tree of life, Buddha being born from her side. These are angels helping with the delivery. As I mentioned, the tree of life is often depicted as bifurcated, so there's two branches. So here we see it. This looks like, it could be an OG swastika. That is a swastika with curved arms going each of the directions here at the center. And the tree of life and the goddess appear often together. They're inseparable, especially in Egypt. This is Nut, in another way she's often portrayed. Nut is shown rising up right out of a tree. She's not standing, she's not a goddess in a tree. She's part tree and part goddess. Her lower part of her body is actually the tree. Her upper part of the body has human forms, and you see she's providing food and drink to the souls of the departed. Again, Nut in the tree of life. Four rivers of fluid are streaming out from her pitcher. In this situation, basically, you have the tree of life and you have arms and a breast. And so the tree and the goddess really are heteromorphic. They share this, you know, they're one and the same. This is the pharaoh, and this is the tree of life, and he's suckling from the breast of the goddess. So it's a tree. Is it a tree? Is it a goddess? Both. Now, here Eve is offering the fruit to Adam, and he's saying, okay, I'll eat it, but it's your fault that this is happening. She's saying, shut up and eat! But interestingly enough, in my explorations, I really only find these two instances where there's an element of culpability and blame. The woman is bad. She has transgressed God's commandment. That appears in the Hebrew. And as I mentioned in the story of Jason and Medea, there's a hint of it also in the Greek. But everywhere else in the world, there's no issues about the woman is evil and has done a bad thing or whatever. The woman, the goddess, and the tree are providers of abundance, of goodness, of blessings, of providence. So I consider this particular development a local development. It's not original to the myth, or you'd see it more frequently. But unfortunately, this is what happened. Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden, and they were sent to the east to live to the east of Eden and earn their living by the sweat of their brow, and she had to bear children in pain. And so they did not return to paradise. An angel with a flaming sword was set to guard the gate. And interestingly enough, this flaming sword turned in every direction. So you have this axial motion and vortex motion in the flaming sword. Always you see that in the Tree of Life, Axis Mundi mythology, it's flaming or it's white, shining, glowing. I wanted to put this on the cover of the book. I love this picture. For some reason, I don't know, I was maybe in my early 20s, I came across, this is by the painter Masaccio, and I came across this, and I just loved this, and I bought, and I've always had it hanging in my house all my life. And when I finally made the synthesis of the Tree of Life, Axis Mundi mythology, and so on, with this, I just really loved this picture and was going to put it in my, my sister said, too religious, your book is not about, it's not about sin and punishment and so on. So, here again, you see same elements creeping into Christian iconography. This is the Virgin Mary. She's sitting in the Tree of Life. These are the fruits of immortality. This is this other spurious local development of the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil, which doesn't really exist in any other culture. Another image from ancient Mexico, an Aztec legend. Here you see the tree. You see it's bifurcated. You see the serpent in the tree. You see the bird. You see the wound in the side of the tree. And some people have the audacity to say that this was the ancient people did not know about the Americas. The Americas, no. The complexity of this legend and how it exists in so many different parts of the world indicate that no, there was diffusion in ancient times. Now, some people say, you know, there's this Jungian idea that, well, all these images, symbols represent elements in the collective unconscious that's accessible by some kind of mental or spiritual process. But one argument against that is that, as I mentioned, there are areas in the world where you don't find this imagery at all, in Australia and sub-Saharan Africa. So if this collective unconscious was truly universal, why doesn't it appear the same everywhere? Perhaps there's a simpler explanation. Another Aztec representation of the Tree of Life. Here you see bifurcated, bird at the crotch of the tree, wound in the side. This is another, this is called the Tree of the Middle Place. And this represents the earth, the ocean of the earth, and the tree is said to grow out of the center of it, but at the same time it's also growing out of the navel of this goddess down below here. And interestingly enough, in the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey, Athena begs Zeus to set Odysseus free. He's held captive on the island of Atlas, island of Calypso, daughter of Atlas, at the navel of the sea, it's said. So often, time and time again, you'll see symbolism. I could bring many illustrations of this where the Tree of Life grows out of the navel of the goddess. Down below here, this is like an alligator's back, but it represents the serpent at the base of the tree. This is Hercules. He's at the base of this tree, and he's capturing Cerberus, the hounds of hell, double-headed hound of hell from the underworld. I love this particular picture. This is Nut again. Remember, she's arching over the Egyptian goddess, arching over the sky. But look at this peculiar configuration of her arms. They don't arise from her shoulders. They arise from her head. But look here. If this is the Milky Way, and if this is the Tree of Life or the goddess, look. She has no feature that would correspond to a head, and so it would be natural to find some explanation. There's a bird constellation right there, so the idea of putting a bird's head on the goddess with the upraised arms makes perfectly good sense. Or the goddess beheaded. or Hercules with his head bowing down below the level of his shoulders as he holds up the earth. So this explains that picture that we just saw of Nut with her arms extending directly from her head rather than from her shoulders. It makes that problem go away. Who's this?
Lita.
Who said that?
Yes, Lita. Yeah, right.
Lita. Zeus took the form of a swan. He flew into her lap, impregnated her. Interestingly, if you read Euripides' play, Helen of Troy, Helen describes her birth, and she says, oh yes, through deception, Zeus impregnated my mother. He took the form of a swan, but he was fleeing an eagle that was chasing him. Here's another depiction of Leda and swan. Renaissance period. This is Europa, another Greek goddess. Here she's got an eagle impregnating her, an eagle between her legs, and the same, and she's sitting in a tree. So you can see the same, she's the Leda. Helen of Troy also was considered originally a tree goddess, decayed to a kind of a human status, but so you see this goddess, she's one with the tree, there's an eagle or a swan between her legs. So here's a depiction drawing of the Milky Way galaxy, and it extends a little farther in both directions, beyond the celestial equator into the southern hemisphere. But you see, here's the Great Rift, the branching pattern of the tree, and here's the swan and the eagle. These are the two dogs that appear so often in the Axis Mundi legends, Canis Major and Canis Minor, the constellations, the serpent Hydra. And remember I mentioned the in the Scandinavian mythology how the Hedron, the goat, lives at the... He nibbles leaves from the highest branch of the tree of life, and from his... from her udder fall down the drops of ambrosia. So, look, here's the highest branch of the tree of life, and here's the constellation Capricorn, the goat, right there. Now, what if, instead of a goddess with upraised arms, one were to look at the Milky Way the other way around, and this was these were her legs. And then, what is right in there between her legs?
Swan.
The swan. And there's the eagle that's chasing the swan that impregnates her. So we can find so many instances where the mythology fits this structure of the galaxy as being the original goddess.
But what is this drawing? Who drew this drawing?
I drew this drawing. I took it from a star map. This is actually the way the galaxy, Milky Way galaxy, appears. And then this is where these constellations are. There are many other constellations, Taurus, the Bull, and Gemini, and so on, but I chose these to put onto this drawing because they exemplify elements of this tree of life mythology. All right. Here is Eve again, up to her tricks, and I love the way she's reaching up to pick the fruit of immortality. And you see this time and time again in the mythology, the goddess reaching for the apple. There was Atalanta reaching for the golden apple that Hippolytus threw before her, or Hera and Athena and Aphrodite reaching for the golden apple, each one of them wanting to receive the golden apple. And here's the serpent. Again, Adam is saying, okay, it's not my fault. But look, here's the goddess reaching up, and she's reaching up and she's touching this particular unusual formation of the galaxy in this particular area. What is this bulge-like structure in the galaxy? This, between Scorpio and Sagittarius, is the most beautiful, bright, and mysterious part of the galaxy. It's actually, if we're looking, this is the center of the galaxy that we're looking at. So you can see, I told you before, this is what we saw before. Our sun is somewhere here. But if you look in this way, you'll see dense stars that are part of the galaxy. But if you look in this direction, you're looking right at the center of it. And ever since I recognized this feature at the center of the galaxy as this bulge in the galaxy that the goddess reaches for, I've been studying this and trying to see it at night. But in our latitudes, it's low to the horizon, and therefore you cannot see it very clearly. Yes, if you carefully pick it out, you'll see between this tail of Scorpio and the stars of Sagittarius, you can pick out this glowing area, but you can't see it very clearly. But about a year ago, I was in Guatemala one night on the shores of Lake Atitlan, and I looked up. I was with some friends. We had eaten dinner, and we were walking home, and I looked up in the sky, and there was this beautiful feature, the center of the galaxy, which is much higher in the sky in those latitudes. And I said, look, it's the center of the galaxy. I've been wanting to see this for years. and oh no, those are just clouds in the sky. No, it is the most beautiful thing. It's like this nebulosity of a circle, and then right in the center is this bright golden glowing center. It's really interesting. This is a photograph of it taken from some, you know, high-powered telescope or the Hubble telescope. I don't know what, but this is what I see. It looks kind of like a cosmic egg or a fruit, and then there's this kind of bright feature there. It's just incredibly mysterious, and so this is my explanation for what this why the goddess is always reaching for this apple of immortality. It represents this mysterious feature of the galaxy. Now, all right, we've identified what this tree of life, what the origin of this tree of life was. I see people looking at their watches, so perhaps we need to wrap up pretty quickly. All right, so what we haven't addressed, just a couple more minutes, what we haven't addressed is, where is this located on the Earth? Okay, yeah, okay, so there's a tree at the center, but where did we imagine, where are these four rivers that flow? So this is another Trojan spindle whirl with an OG swastika. I'm saying that perhaps these represent the rivers of paradise that converge at the center. And there are indications that the swastika symbol is connected with rivers. This is a bronze pin from Bavaria, and you see the river meanders paralleling the outer arms of the swastika. Oops. This is from the Caucasus, Armenia. Here again, this is a bronze cincture, and here you see these rivers crossing at the center. So definitely looks like could be a plausible explanation for the meaning of the swastika, river symbols. This is from ancient Scandinavia, about 800 BC, gold and silver pendant. There again, you see this OG swastika and these kind of meandering symbols, river symbols. This is from Greece, swastika, these wave patterns, fish and water birds, giving the impression that these are river symbols. And then I made this observation that if you take the four continents bordering the Atlantic Ocean, the four rivers, the largest rivers on each of these continents, stand in relation to each other as the outer arms of a giant swastika. The Nile, the Mississippi, the Amazon, and the Baltic all fit this pattern. And interestingly enough, the center, the vertex of it, is right in the position that the ancients described this continent, this island of Atlantis, the island of Atlas. These are the Azores Islands that may perhaps have been known. I mean, there were ancient coins discovered there, so perhaps the ancient people knew this. And so if this were the case, then the ancient conception of the Tree of Life, which was the vertex, the distaff through the disk of the Earth, crossed at the center point, the navel of the Earth, alignment with the great cosmic alignment of the north and south axis and the center of the Earth. So that perhaps ancient navigators discovered the position of these rivers and developed the symbol of the swastika from them. Now, there are reasons to imagine why this could have happened, because, as I mentioned, gold, the Amazon River was a great source of gold, and in the ancient world, in the Eridanus, the Baltic was a great source of amber, and ancient people kept these things secret. If they knew the way to the Amazonian gold fields or the sea route to the amber fields, they didn't tell anybody. This was a closely kept secret, but still preserved in the symbolism. And
could you explain the relationship with that last slide, that point to the poles? I didn't get that.
So, ancient people could see where the celestial pole was, but they had no idea where the pole on the Earth was.
I was talking about the North Pole.
Yeah, they didn't know if the North Pole was in the Arctic Circle or where. They assumed that it was somewhere out in the ocean, and we're at the confluence of these four rivers. We have to wind up here quickly. I'm starting to get pressure from these. And when the galaxy was seen as a goddess, then she was, this is how she was conceived, or as Atlas, standing on her on his island, supporting the heavens from that point. Notice also here, Atlas is the thing that I was talking about, this something was wrong with this picture before. Notice how the earth is oriented. This is Africa, this is the Mediterranean, this is Italy, this is Greece. This should be oriented so that the axis mundi is intersecting at the North Pole. But where is it intersecting? Here's the Pillars of Hercules, the Straits of Gibraltar. It's out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. An indication that people knew this. Now, I could talk more, I could go on, but I think we have to stop. I would talk about the ancient symbols of the serpent with his two heads representing the form of the galaxy. So a serpent with two heads, or often this great rift was seen as the mouth of the serpent, and the galaxy goes all the way around the earth and meets again at the mouth. So this is the origin of this Ouroboros symbol. Hold on. So more of the Ouroboros. So there's much more evidence and many interesting things that can be found in my book Tree of Life Mythical Architect. They have copies for sale here. And I'd encourage anybody to take a look at it if you're interested in going further into it. But before we break up, there are a couple of announcements that have to be.
There are a couple of announcements. First, thank you so much. And I will point out that we have a donation bowl at the back there, and we encourage people to contribute to it to support this space for having talks like this and to support your speaker and his work. Thank you so much for coming tonight, and we look forward to seeing you at further events here at the Universe. Thank you. And I'm sure our speaker would be happy to chat more.
I've done it.